mountains, deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the February 2025 issue of Arizona Highways. I'm going to start out today with the editor's letter by Robert Steve. Old Black and Whites of Saguaro National Monument. That was the plan for our portfolio, but the best laid plans of mice and men and magazine stories often go awry. Not even Lisa Altamar, our art director, could find the right mix of images. That's rare. Like a kid on the beach with a metal detector, she usually digs up whatever we need. Not this time, though. She did, however, find David Swing. His name was familiar. I'd seen something on him in one of our early issues, but I didn't know much about the man who has been described as the Dean of Southwest Artists. I've learned a lot in the past few weeks. David Carrick Swing was born in Cincinnati and studied art under Thomas Corwin Lindsay, a renowned landscape painter in the Queen City. He studied music, too, with private tutors who helped fine-tune his prodigious talent. That's what led him to Los Angeles, where he played violin, cello, and trumpet in several orchestras. He also opened a landscape and interior design firm in downtown L.A. and an art studio in Pasadena. He stayed in Southern California for many years, and then, in 1917, he moved to the Sonoran Desert to play stringed instruments with the Phoenix Symphony. Like so many other transplants, he fell in love with the Arizona landscape and started painting it. Later, when the Great Depression was at its worst, he looked to the government for work. It paid off. In 1935, he was hired by the Federal Art Project, the visual arts arm of the Works Progress Administration, to paint four murals at the Tuberculosis Sanitarium in Papago Park and a series of panels for the new library at Phoenix Junior College, where he was on the faculty as an art instructor. Around that same time, he was commissioned by the WPA to create, with artist Florence Blakeslee, the 23 bas-relief terracotta medallions that ring the grandstand at the Arizona State Fairgrounds. His work was everywhere, wrote Peter Birmingham, the author of New Deal in the Southwest, Arizona and New Mexico. For sheer acreage of painted canvas, no other Arizona artist in the 30s could rival David Swing. Nevertheless, David Swing is not a household name. Not even Bruce Aiken, our modern-day Dean of Southwest Artists, was familiar. I've not heard of him specifically, he told me, but the New Deal art program was one of the best things we've done in America to leave an artistic and aesthetic legacy in our public spaces. As you know, art is what we save, treasure, and honor as a society. Art enhances our lives and uplifts so many people just by seeing it. By the way, that program literally saved many artists during the Great Depression. The Depression ended in 1939. That's when David Swing launched his most ambitious project. He had been commissioned by the Arizona legislature to paint a series of murals for the Golden Gate International Exposition in San Francisco, which opened on February 18th of that year. It has been our good fortune to see some of the murals that artist David Swing is getting ready for the Arizona exhibit at the San Francisco World's Fair, editor Raymond Carlson wrote in our March 1939 issue. There will be 14 murals depicting a scenic wonder from each of Arizona's counties. The murals are 5 feet by 10 feet and are being beautifully and artistically done as befits this glorious state and as bespeaks the genius of one of the state's most noted artists. Although it was billed as a World's Fair, technically it wasn't because its planners never got around to requesting official status from the Bureau International des Expositions, the French organization that regulates World's Fairs. But in every other way, it was. Treasure Island, a man-made landmass in the middle of San Francisco Bay, was built exclusively for the expo, and so were dozens of spectacular Art Deco buildings dedicated to various themes. One of them was the Hall of Western States. The friendly invitation, Howdy, partners. Welcome to Arizona is extended to visitors who enter Arizona's exhibit in the Hall of Western States, Stephen Shadegg wrote in our June 1939 issue. In the foyer of the building, 14 scenic murals painted especially for the exposition by David Swing defy the limits of space. All the murals are framed in the ribs of the sororal cactus, and the unusual wood arouses considerable comment. Its soft, satiny finish forms an effective setting for the scenic paintings. In all, 17 million people passed through the turnstiles at the expo, many of whom presumably saw the artwork of Mr. Swing, along with murals by Dana Dixon and Diego Rivera, and a photo exhibit by Ansel Adams. Back in Phoenix, the dean continued adding to the acreage of his painted canvas, which includes murals in Radio City Music Hall and the home of filmmaker Thomas Ince, the father of the Western. The only thing that slowed him down was disaster. In November 1941, the attic, roof, and two rear rooms in his home on Adams Street were destroyed by a fire. According to George Simpson, the deputy fire chief, the blaze was caused by the spontaneous ignition of several oily garments and rags in a supply room. Fortunately, the artist was able to save most of his paintings before the house went up in flames. But sadly, the end was near. On June 1, 1945, Mr. Swing died in his Phoenix home after a long illness. 80 years later, he makes a return to the pages of Arizona highways, pages that were supposed to be filled with old black and whites of Sororal National Monument. The best laid plans, sometimes they go awry, and sometimes that's okay, as long as you have a good metal detector on hand. And this concludes Editor's Letter. This month, February in History. On February 3, 1913, newspapers reported that a band of 15 wolves was menacing ranchers and cattle near Prescott as a result of deep snow in the wolves' mountain habitat. Anson P.K. Safford, who served as the third governor of the Arizona Territory from 1869 to 1877 and played a leading role in creating the territory's public school system, was born in Hyde Park, Vermont on February 14, 1830. On February 22, 1876, a five-stamp quartz mill began operations at Mineral Park, a mining town in northwestern Arizona. Copper mining continues at Mineral Park today, but the community is now a ghost town. And this concludes This Month in History. Matt Jaffe is the author of Michael Catutwa Johnson. Michael Catutwa Johnson considers himself a 250th generation farmer. His Hopi ancestors began working their native land more than 3,000 years ago. He's a teacher, too, an environmental expert who's committed to sharing his knowledge and the joys of farming with younger members of indigenous communities. Coming up through the Painted Desert from Flagstaff, you'll pull into the Kaikatsmovi Village convenience store where Michael Catutwa Johnson greets us. He's a faculty member at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment and a core faculty member of the UA's Indigenous Resilience Center. Today, he wears a shirt with broad, faded stripes and a pair of loose-fitting pants. He's dressed for a day of farming. Johnson climbs into his copper-colored 1974 Ford F-250, dinged in a few spots and spattered with dried sandstone mud, and leads us up a dusty road to the farm. He pulls over at a Hopi-style building with irregular stonework and a ladder jutting above the roofline. While many academics spend their careers cloistered in the proverbial ivory tower, Johnson works for much of the year from this traditional stone and adobe house. It took him almost 20 years to craft the rambling structure room by room. 6 inches of dirt insulates the roof. The ceilings are low and the walls are regular, but the house is modern enough to have an office with Wi-Fi and traditional enough to have a round, kiva-like space for contemplation. Johnson's voice is gentle, with hints of music in it, befitting the opera career to which he aspired. He speaks in rapid-fire paragraphs, if not always with periods, before punctuating his most cogent points with a resonant laugh. The house isn't all straight corners, and it's a little bit hard to keep clean, he says, but this is just home, just natural. When it leaks, it leaks. Then I just patch everything right back up. and it didn't cost that much. Johnson stays here with his Belgian Malinois soya, named for a Hopi farming tool, dry farming corn, beans, squash, and melons. From a dining room lit by a wagon wheel chandelier, the windows look toward the cornfield. For anyone accustomed to the Midwest's heavily fertilized, densely planted, and artificially lush factory farms, Johnson's crop, widely spaced and planted in neat rows on a bare, sandy rectangle, looks nothing like a field of dreams. But he's not raising some endlessly hybridized corn variety. He's growing crops uniquely adapted to Hopi lands. "I'm a 250th generation farmer," he says. "We've been farming for over 3,000 years. Yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but there's something really tranquil about hard work. This is an honest thing to do." Johnson grew up in Winslow, where his mother taught junior high and his father, a one-time military chaplain, served as pastor at the Presbyterian Church. "My dad would drop me off up here in summertime when I was 10 years old, and I learned how to farm," he recalls. "I used to hate it because there was only one TV station, but it was good. I learned a lot of stuff back then that still guides me." Johnson originally focused on music and hoped to get a PhD in vocal pedagogy. He received a full scholarship to Arizona State University, then struggled with music theory, and eventually studied agriculture at Cornell University. "It was a different type of egg. Nothing like this," he says, gesturing toward his corn. "All mechanical. They want you to get a 14-row John Deere planter," and I thought, "That's crazy. I can get 14 Hopi and put John Deere hats on them and watch them go to town." And out comes that laugh. Johnson's academic work includes a recent needs analysis of how traditional agriculture is still practiced by the Hopi people and New Mexico's Pueblo tribes. "It's interrelated with our ceremonies and our cultural beliefs," he says. "There's no separation. We need traditional agriculture to survive in this world." He's especially committed to sharing his knowledge and the joys of farming with younger members of indigenous communities. Johnson believes that the disconnect between modern society and food production has had especially adverse impacts on indigenous people who suffer from high rates of diabetes and diet-related health issues. In many respects, Johnson's work comes down to planting seeds, literally and figuratively. School groups come out to see the farm in his house, and in Tucson, in partnership with United Way, he started One Seed, One Child, a program that gives elementary school kids the fundamental experience of raising a plant from just a seed, a cup of dirt, and water. "I'm more focused on having those kids learn why they're farming," he says. "What are the values behind agriculture?" He sees another connection between seeds and children. Without asking for permission or offering compensation, multinational corporations have used seeds from indigenous lands to develop new genetic varieties of corn and other crops. Johnson sees these seeds as a form of intellectual property and, more importantly, as living beings that belong to the tribes. "It's a harsh reality," he says, "but I call our seeds the new boarding school children, because they've been taken away from us and propagated wrongly. They need to come home." Sometimes seeds do come home. A friend gave Johnson 800-year-old corn found buried in a Glen Canyon cave in the 1960s before Lake Powell inundated the site. "They're actually growing," Johnson says, of the seeds of that corn. "Last year, I planted them too deep and they came up underground. But this year they did come up and I've been nurturing them. Got cages around them because of the crows. Crows happen, but this is an act of faith. Keeps me grounded. This is a place of healing for me." And this concludes Michael Katutwa Johnson. An essay by Chandan Mayo is entitled Painful Lessons. By the 1920s, more than 60,000 indigenous children were enrolled in boarding schools, having been forcibly removed from their homes and placed there. Last year, on behalf of the federal government, President Joe Biden formally apologized for the establishment of those schools. The effects of the program, however, still linger with many of the survivors and their descendants. "The only things my mother heard were the sounds of children's cries, whimpers, and soft footsteps as they fled into the night, and she hid in fear beneath a thin, unfamiliar white blanket. Reduced to a silent observer, she was raised during the boarding school era, when her days began with making her bed and rigorous exercise as if in preparation for military deployment. She ate breakfast from a cold tray alongside her fellow students. Her long brown hair was trimmed to a few inches, partly obscuring her face. It was worse for my grandmother, who was forcibly taken from her home in Arizona by strange men and transported on horseback through the desert to the Intermountain Indian School in Brigham City, Utah, and for my grandmother's sister, who returned home bearing a forearm tattoo inscribed with unfamiliar symbols that represented her assigned English name within the system. I am grateful for my mother, who endured and survived so I could be brought into this world with my brothers. Our memory acts as a tribute to our family legacy and a story for the future that will safeguard our ancestral heritage and resilience. My mother, grandmother, and many other relatives are just a small part of our community that was forced to adapt to Western society. In 1900, there were 20,000 indigenous children in boarding schools, according to the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. By 1925, that number had more than tripled. Overall, from 1819 to the 1970s, the United States enacted policies that created and maintained Indian boarding schools throughout the country. These institutions aimed to culturally assimilate Native American, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian children by forcibly separating them from their families, communities, languages, religions, and cultural practices. During their time at these boarding schools, many children, like my grandmother and mother, suffered physical and emotional abuse, and some lost their lives. In June 2021, Secretary Deb Haaland and the U.S. Department of the Interior initiated efforts to confront the difficult history associated with federal Indian boarding school policies. Through the creation of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative, the United States government aims to address the intergenerational effects of these policies and highlight the historical and ongoing trauma experienced by indigenous communities. The initiative reports that 973 students lost their lives during the boarding school era. Given the dark nature of this period in American history, the project stands out as one of the few documents that reveal the trauma of the era. However, due to inconsistent federal reporting on child deaths, including their numbers, causes, and burial sites, the accuracy of such figures remains uncertain. An investigative report by the initiative identified more than 50 marked or unmarked burial sites across the former boarding school system, underscoring the urgency of honoring the memories of those who suffered and providing a clearer understanding of the effect of those schools on indigenous populations. While many indigenous families share a common history marked by extensive assimilation, the experiences of that era have led indigenous people down vastly different life paths. I can see that in my recent matrilineal line, whose lives were profoundly altered by their time in boarding schools. They could have remained integral members of their northern Arizona communities, deeply connected to their cultural heritage. Instead, they became wanderers. My grandmother returned to Arizona years after her boarding school experience, but she was irrevocably changed and never fully regained her sense of self. My mother didn't return at all and drifted even further from her cultural roots. While she is aware of her heritage, her connection to it has been severed, as evident in her limited cultural understanding and her reluctance to teach me the Navajo language. I think that stems in part from her experience of institutional violence and wanting to protect my siblings and me. As a result, I too have grown further away from my culture, not only geographically, but also culturally, because two generations of my family were separated from it. Growing up, I always wondered what my life would have been like if boarding schools had never existed. Would I be a full dine? Or half, like I am now? Would I have grown up on the Navajo Nation and learned how to ride horses and play in the canyons, like my mom did growing up? Or would I be doing half as much as I am now? While my grandmother and mother faced forceful evictions from their homes, I felt a desire to enroll in a different kind of boarding school as I approached high school. I wanted to attend Mount Edgecombe High School, which was nearly 700 miles away from our home in Fairbanks, Alaska, and reachable only by plane or boat. My family was among the few indigenous families in Fairbanks, and I wanted to be surrounded by other indigenous students and connect with my community, a challenge for many indigenous people, given that only about 1% of the U.S. population identifies as American Indian or Alaska Native. Instead, I eventually enrolled at a public high school where I was the sole Native student in the classroom. During my undergraduate years, I sought out people who resembled me, seeking a sense of refuge in what felt like an unending desert. There, too, I longed to be part of an indigenous community, but again, I faced challenges. According to the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute, only about 17% of American Indians and Alaska Natives aged 25 or older have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, a rate significantly below the national average of 36%. As a result, I often find myself explaining my identity, educating others, or putting in extra effort to have my viewpoint acknowledged as valid. When I do encounter other indigenous students in academic settings or elsewhere, I recognize the collective effort it took for us to reach this point in an environment that has not always been welcoming. We have navigated the challenges and traumas experienced by our parents and grandparents, and perhaps formed a bond as exiles from the boarding school era, connected by the threads of our shared history. There were about 523 known Indian boarding schools in the United States, according to the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. On a late October day in 2024, survivors of some of those facilities fill a gym on the Gila River Indian community on the outskirts of Phoenix as their memories ebb and flow. Some occupy the bleachers while others gather around tables to listen to President Joe Biden, who has come to offer a formal apology on behalf of the federal government for the establishment of boarding schools. Elders, their families, and people like me, people who live with the consequences of the government's actions, are gathered en masse for once. I can see the faces, hear the voices, weathered hands and tired eyes from history are standing before me. I'm tasked with reporting for ICT, formerly Indian Country Today. In the sea of people, I spot my journalism mentor, Patty Telahungva, a survivor herself. She buzzes around the gymnasium, shaking hands and hugging other survivors. With her encouragement, I interview others and hear their stories. I hear, "My grandfather was a student at Phoenix Indian, and I was a boarding school student." That's Adila Stanley, a Tohono O'odham. "I went to Phoenix High School, and my mother and my late father went there, as well as my aunt, my mom's sister, and then my sister and a couple of my cousins," says Eleanor Massawamptawa, a Hopi. Every participant, united by a common history and family bonds, gathers for the apology, which signifies the end of an important chapter in their lives. Holland, the Interior Secretary, is introduced by Susanna Osif, Miss Gila River for 2024-25. Dressed in traditional regalia, she confidently addresses the audience, expressing her commitment to her people. "I'm here for my ancestors, for my people," she says. "I'm here to give a stand and speak my voice for those who couldn't speak before. I'm here because of my leadership. I'm here because I was taught that generationally we have to ensure that we are taking these opportunities for our next generations, and me being here is a symbol of that. For my ancestors, despite the historical challenges and the continuous trauma faced by survivors and their descendants, people who endure the boarding school system continue to greet the rising sun in the east each day. Before my grandmother died in 2020, she created a sanctuary in her hogan, a traditional yet modern home my extended family had built together. While I was an undergraduate at Northern Arizona University, I often visited her. She loved watching classic Western films, weaving rugs on her loom from the wool of sheep she had sheared, and occasionally taking walks through her garden, which was a sea of green in an unforgiving desert. She nurtured her peach trees, looked after an unusual spruce, and frequently harvested large zucchinis, a common food item at our family's dinner table. Her home consistently welcomed visitors, and I remember family members conversing in Navajo, their laughter filling the air. As my grandmother's time on earth neared its end, I asked about her experiences in boarding school. Instantly, her demeanor changed, her expression became somber, and her gaze drifted as if she had been transported back in time. The silence stretched on as she carefully chose her words in English, and I found myself holding my breath anticipating a vivid narrative similar to those depicted in films. But the remainder of our day was enveloped in silence. She did recall the moment her sister returned home to the female Hogan on horseback, dressed in pristine white clothing and sporting a neat haircut with bangs. My grandmother had come back from the desert, where she was either sheep herding or working with livestock. Along with others, she welcomed her sister back home and stood in awe of how sharply her own appearance in tattered jeans and worn cowboy boots contrasted with her sister's. Now, as night falls, the Hogan remains empty except for my older brother and uncle, who have settled there to honor my grandmother's memory and their own presence on tribal land. The sunset happens quickly. The canyon curves through the desert terrain, uncovering the trails my grandmother walked during her time as a sheep herder. The thin clouds adopt a magenta tint, drifting and stretching across the sky as the sun slowly sinks into the earth, casting the world into darkness. And this concludes Painful Lessons. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.